Of our meeting on our joint working group for the California Language Access Plan. We do have Spanish language interpreters available in the event there's anyone who is in need of that. I would ask the interpreter announce that they are available and the services they will provide.
Hola, buenas tardes. Hay servicios de interpretación disponibles. Si alguien quiere seguir la sesión en español, puede ir aquí a hablar con mi compañera, que le dará un auricular. Y si alguien quiere hacer algún comentario en español, con todo gusto lo interpretaremos al inglés. Gracias.
Gracias. We'll proceed at this point. It's based on the number of individuals that have requested to speak. You'll be allotted at this point 5 minutes per presentation, and about the 1 minute mark, we will remind you in case you're getting close to the 5 minute mark. The first person we have is Mary Lou Aragunan from CFI.
Good afternoon, members of the working group and chairs. I actually did not come today with prepared comments, but I wanted to just take a moment to thank the working group for the really amazing work that you've taken on and the scope of the work. Just to make a couple of general comments, we have submitted extensive written comments at two stages. Wanted to just sort of emphasize some of the larger points in our commentary, which is that change is difficult, and the scope of changes that are contemplated under this plan are ambitious. On the other hand, it's easy to get caught up in the complexities and the sense of, that it's overwhelming to make this level of change. But if you look at the history of civil rights in this country and recognizing civil rights, and it's really important that institutions and governments have the courage to recognize what must be done and to make these mandates. So a big thrust of our comments is that these guidelines should not be guidelines, but should be mandates that are recognized. And we actually believe that this will make it easier for the courts to follow and to implement what I think everyone shares as a goal. We should have no less regard for LEP rights than for any other protected class. And just as it was difficult for people to get accustomed to the disabilities, Americans with Disabilities Act as something that, you know, and recognize those rights, we need to go through that same process with LEP rights. And having these be requirements is key to that. I would also just highlight that, language access, legal services providers have submitted comments very similar to our comments, and we believe that our comments are in line with what the Department of Justice also sees as just necessary to really realize the goal that everyone shares. The effort, the idea of letting courts figure this out on their own has been tried over the last 20 or 30 years, and we believe that language access is something that really merits a statewide approach and consistent standards that are developed, and that courts need support on a statewide level from the Judicial Council and all stakeholders to make this happen. On the other issue, of course, that's very important to us and that you know is important to us is the remote interpreting. We understand and recognize, as we have repeatedly over the course of these discussions, that it will form some part of expanding language access, but we're very intent on continuing to advocate that it needs to be restricted. There needs to be a pilot project or something that very carefully looks at this. We would urge you to recommend a pilot project as opposed to experimentation by individual courts and a kind of ad hoc approach to implementing remote interpreting. And with that, I thank you. I look forward to listening to the discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next individual we'll call upon is Laura Alvarez from Bay Area Legal Aid.
Good afternoon. I actually have an illustrated photo with me, and I unfortunately didn't bring enough copies, but if you wouldn't mind passing those along and sharing them if possible. I am a family law attorney with Bay Area Legal Aid, specifically the San Francisco office. And just to let you know, Bay Area Legal Aid of San Francisco in the family law department only represents victims of domestic violence. And that would include cases of divorce, restraining orders, child custody, and child support proceedings. The reason we only represent domestic violence victims generally is because there are not enough of us. So we are, while representing our individual clients, also very concerned for all of the pro per litigants who we have to decline representation to because we simply do not have the resources. So with that in mind, I'm here because I'm very concerned about what's happening in our San Francisco courts. And I'd like the Judicial Council to know how the strategic plan specifically will have an impact on the local courts. And just for background, my organization, Bay Area Legal Aid, has signed on to an extensive written comment. So I won't go into detail too much about and this won't be the longest comment. I want to focus on what's happening in San Francisco. My concern is that...
Joining the meeting.
My concern is that the strategic plan, the language access plan as written, does not include any mandatory actions by counties. And to the extent that it does, the deadlines, the time frames are so drawn out. So that my concern is that local courts will not take any mandates seriously. San Francisco is a prime example. If you take a look at the goals for interpreters in all courts in the plan, the requirement is if as soon as is feasible and no later than 2020, qualified interpreters will be provided to LEP users in all courtroom proceedings. And then, of course, there are some shorter time frames which require prioritization. San Francisco, for years, has been providing interpreters in all family law cases where a party spoke limited English and a written request was made. And that is something that as soon as I got to San Francisco, having previously practiced in Georgia, I truly appreciated. Just a month ago, San Francisco changed their policy so that they are no longer providing interpreters in all family law cases. They are only providing interpreters in cases involving domestic violence and cases involving the Department of Child Support Services. This is very problematic, even for our clients who are domestic violence victims. We have a number of cases where, first of all, any family law case that involves custody of children, where you have a English-speaking parent and a non-English-speaking parent, the English-speaking parent is going to be at an advantage if the other parent is unable to pay for a proficient court-certified interpreter. Now, we have a number of cases that involve custody where there is sex abuse, where the evidence hasn't been strong enough for a criminal case to open, where the evidence hasn't been strong enough for a parent to obtain a domestic violence restraining order. And in those cases, a parent can be entering into the court system and under the new policy, have no right to an interpreter and have no right to essentially fight for her child's rights to be with the parent who is the non-sex abuser. Now, we have countless other examples of situations that are on the border where it is almost essentially going to happen that the parent who is non-English speaking will be deprived of their access to justice if they are not provided with an interpreter, even though they are a domestic violence victim. So I'm told that my time is up, my time is coming to a close. I would encourage all of you to take a look at the sign that was just posted in the family court clerk's office. It now indicates that and this is part of the policy change, litigants in family courts do not have a right to an interpreter. It tells litigants in five languages, if you do not speak English well and you need an interpreter, bring an interpreter, which is a pretty clear violation of federal requirements. So I thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next, call upon Lorraine Klein from the Legal Aid Association of California.
Good afternoon. My name is Lauren Klein. I'm an attorney at the Legal Aid Association of California. We are the statewide membership organization for the almost 100 legal services organizations in California. We want to recognize and appreciate the effort that the working group has put forth thus far in the development of the statewide language access plan, and we want to thank you for this opportunity today to provide some additional feedback. We did provide written comments, as did many of our member programs, but today I just wanted to share with you a couple of concerns that have been recently raised by our member programs. We've heard from legal services providers throughout the state that at the local court level, some courts have stopped providing interpreters where they previously did provide them. We believe this is because local courts are hesitant to act ahead of the Language Access Plan's formal adoption. The message that courts can, right now, provide interpreters even before the adoption of the plan is a message that's not being heard by all local courts. We would urge the Judicial Council to make sure that courts don't wait for the official direction of the plan to provide interpreters. The ability to provide interpreters as justice so requires is a directive that is already supported by state statute and by case law, and that's a message that local courts aren't necessarily getting. This remains especially crucial for fee waiver litigants who, without an interpreter, are essentially denied their day in court. The overarching concern is that courts might be waiting to provide interpreters until they are directed by the plan. The draft plan's lengthy timeline, along with rigid priorities, including legislative priorities, might further lend to this confusion among local courts. We believe that the Judicial Council's ability to clarify the immediate provision of interpreters in California's courts would be a timely and positive step forward in addressing this concern before the plan's official adoption. Another concern that's voiced by legal service organizations has been the plan's lack of strong language, specifically in declaring that state law does not require interpreters for civil matters. Again, we would urge the Judicial Council to ensure that courts understand their existing obligations to provide interpreters. Finally, our members would encourage the Judicial Council's monitoring of local courts to ensure that current surplus funds are being spent to increase access to interpreters, as provided by the Trial Court Trust Fund Program 4545 savings. Some local courts have taken successful steps to increase provision of interpreters even before the plan has been finalized, and we would encourage that the Judicial Council informs all local courts that they don't have to wait for plan adoption or legislation to expand language access for court users. Thank you again for this opportunity to comment.
Thank you.
That appears to be the three individuals that did sign up to speak on the topic. So at this point, we will close the public comment portion of the meeting, and we'll continue with our meeting on our joint working group for our California Language Access Plan review.
Right. I think, are we providing notice about tomorrow morning? Yeah. It is a possibility that when we reconvene the meeting tomorrow, we will need to go into closed session for some period of time, and I just want to give notice to all of you folks there, but we're not certain. It'll depend on what happens today. So I just wanted to let you know that that's a possibility for tomorrow morning.
Okay. So shall we begin back at the beginning? I'm going to ask Justice Zeilon to walk us through. We have some comments that come out of our initial discussions, and I'm going to ask Justice Zeilon to describe the ideas that came out of our closed session meetings so that they can be considered and discussed by the committee as a whole.
And remind everyone that, again, this is an open, it's not a closed session, it's an open session. It is being recorded. And so if you are going to make a comment, so those who may be listening in, that you state your name before you indicate with your comment.
We, okay.
They can listen in. We're not having public comment, but for those listening to know who is speaking, they identify yourself before you speak.
Okay. This is Elon. Thank you. We discussed, began our discussions of some of the recommendations that had been made. We've not completed our discussions, but I can report on our progress to date. On recommendation number 8, which was the expansion of court interpreters to all civil proceedings in phased processes, there were several issues that arose. First of all, the new legislation has a slight difference in priority setting from the priorities put in the draft plan. We discussed that, and at least our working group believes at this point and is recommending to the group that the legislative priorities be adopted as the priorities of this group, and the implementation committee be asked to work through those priorities and provide guidance to the courts on what each of the categories entails and encompasses, so that they are able to do that. The second issue, major issue in that area, had to do with the priority setting and whether, as some comments provided, that all of the phasing be moved into phases 1 and 2 so that there was no portion of it left for phase 3. We agree with that at this point, that it should be a goal to complete the implementation by the end of phase 2, and that the goal should be the recommendation.
Is that all on 8?
That's on 7. 8, sorry. Yeah, that's all on 8.
Are you done on 8? I just want to do each one at a time so that
yes.
We can open discussion.
The only other issue in 8, it really has to do with the issue of family court services mediation. And because in some number of counties, the family court services mediation is a recommending mediation, which is similar in nature to a binding arbitration, it was our sense that that should be moved up in priority.
Is that going to conflict with the statute?
We don't believe so.
Okay. Okay. So we open up discussion on the proposal that Group 1 has brought to us. Is there anything anyone wants to change or add or subtract on those issues? Nope, hearing none. That's great. I have a question, and that is in listening to the public comment today, is there some language we can add to 8 that basically says, do it all now if you can? And as opposed, we say qualified interpreters will be provided in the California courts in all these events. And then we say, if immediate expansion overtaxes the resources, then do it this way, this way, this way. And I think it's implicit in those two sentences that we want immediate expansion, but perhaps it's not as implicit as I thought it was, or perhaps we should make it explicit rather than implicit.
I don't think that would be inconsistent with the discussions that Group 1 had. Certainly, the last paragraph in 8, which talks about the goal being to provide well before 2020, would be moved up to be 2017, but I do not think that, and members of the group, if I'm misspeaking, please correct me, would object to adding something in the first couple of sentences that said that it should be provided as soon as possible, and then go into the other one.
Any discussion on that? Okay, so staff can prepare some language on that. Great. Okay, next item. Oh, yeah, no one disagrees about moving family court services up into phase one, right? Okay, good. All right.
Okay. Number nine, which is the issue of the adoption of a rule of court for provisional qualification requirements. Similarly to what we just discussed, believe that some language should be added, that this rule should be prepared as soon as is practicable. We did discuss whether it could be moved into phase one, but given the schedule of getting a rule to council, we do not think that the rule could be prepared, sent for public comment, and adopted by council by the end of 2015 under the current strictures. And so we wanted to add language that the rule be adopted as soon as practicable, but leaving it in phase two. Other than that, we were not suggesting any changes to recommendation number nine, although there are, again, some implementation issues dealing with the interpretation of the existing rule 2.893, which is to be used as a model for that. And so, but that we thought was an implementation drafting issue rather than a recommendation issue.
Does this recommendation says use 2.893 for now?
Correct.
For the civil cases?
Correct. Okay. But the new rule, in adopting the new rule, we'd like people to consider whether there have been any issues in the use of the old rule that could be clarified as long as the new rule is being adopted.
Okay. All right, any discussion on recommendation nine and the new rule for provisional
quotes? I got a little bit confused just now by your question. Because the proposed rule of court is 70-something, I don't remember the number, recommendation-something, for the provisional qualification. But 9 is saying, pending adoption of a rule of court, what do we do now? And the way that the joint working group has been discussing, the intent is that provisional qualification be followed as early as possible. So would that be a phase one issue? Pending the rule of adoption, which would be phase two, what do we do immediately in civil cases?
Okay. We did not discuss it, but the only reason that we had any discussion, and I'm looking to members of my group, the only reason we had any discussion about not moving it into phase one was the inability to get a rule adopted in phase one. If this is the interim before the rule is adopted, I don't think there would be any objection to moving into phase one because we all thought it should be done as soon as humanly possible.
Yeah, that's right.
Is that right?
And for reference, 71 is the that addresses the rule of court.
You're correct. So then the recommendation would be to move this to phase one.
Okay. Was that in phase two?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. All righty.
10. 10 is the provision of qualified interpreters in court-ordered, court-operated proceedings. There were a number of comments on this that had to do with, in large part, what we meant by court-ordered, court-operated proceedings. And our recommendation is that we should make clear that the programs we're referring to initially are both court-operated and court-ordered. There's an and there, not an or. And that we provide some additional definitions so that it's clear what we were talking about in terms of the programs that are covered by this rule. There were suggestions that language be added that says no later than 2016 for this. We weren't comfortable with that, but we were comfortable with the recommendation made that said beginning immediately as resources are available to replace the beginning in 2015 as resources are available. we discussed the issue of third-party programs which are not directly controlled by the courts. They're not operated by the courts or controlled by the courts, but the court provides referrals. For example, domestic violence batterers programs and other programs. It was the view of our group and our recommendation that language be added that courts not order parties to attend programs unless the programs can provide services in a language that is spoken by the party. The concern there, of course, is that many of these programs, the orders to these programs have a criminal component, and that failure to attend a program can result in the violation of probation and other criminal consequences. Litigants may find themselves and do find themselves in a position where they are ordered to attend a program which does not provide services in a language that makes it comprehensible to them, or that provides those services only some months out after the period of compliance that the court has ordered. And we recognize that this is a change in the recommendation that was sent out, but we recommend it to the group.
Where, I'm sorry, and that is?
That would be, in our original discussion, we said nothing about programs that that the court does not control.
Third-party
programs. So we're suggesting that language be added to address the third-party program situation.
Okay, great. And before we leave that and open it to discussion, just to clarify, are you proposing clarifying definition of court order / court operated?
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
And proposing also.
Do we need to hear that?
Well, it's not written, is
oh,
the problem.
Okay. That's what I thought. Okay.
And also, we would be proposing language concerning defining court proceedings so that it's clear, because there was some question in the comments about, well, if you're here in the court, is that a court proceeding? If they send you out to a mediator, is that a court proceeding? So we would like to work on some language that would define court proceedings
right,
as well.
And there was one comment that came in that wouldn't technically fall into the definition of court-ordered, court-operated, and that's a situation where it's in the unlawful detainer court and the judge sends everybody out in the hall and says you have to have a settlement discussions. And, you know, we need to make sure that it includes those types.
That's why we want to define court proceedings.
Okay. All right. On that proposal, any discussion, suggestions, subtractions, additions?
A question. If we have language that says they're not to court order a program, such as a batterers program, such as a DUI program, but it's required in the code, How are we going to deal with those issues? Ordering someone to do these things as a term and condition, and then that service is available. I mean, you have to order it because under DV, they need to order the 52 weeks batterers treatment program. I think it's mandatory under the code if they have on there.
Yeah, I think the thinking of the group was that there is an office in every court that works with local programs to know what services they provide and which are appropriate to make court orders to attend, which are not appropriate to make court orders to attend, and that there will have to be some work with the community to have those programs understand that they need to provide services in order to remain on the list of acceptable programs for the court to stay with. I mean, the court can't order a program to bring in a Hmong interpreter, but the court can say to a program, we won't send anybody to you unless you provide interpreters. And that's going to take some implementation and some phase-in, but the concern over having litigants ordered to complete programs which they literally cannot complete is, we think, an important concern in this area.
And in addition, you know, it's also meant, I think, to sort of sensitize judges as well to this issue so that judges aren't so quick to, you know, find parole or probation violation if an individual is sent to a program where they didn't understand what the content of the program was. so that, you know, yes, and the primary thrust of the recommendation is as Lori has stated, but there is that secondary aspect as well, that judges need to be sensitive to this issue as well.
That is, it has to be a willful violation, not just a violation, but a willful violation and ability to comply. But does that go away from the, I mean, are we going to, in the other aspect, do we address the need to provide that level of service if there's really a need? I mean, we're sending individuals to like a battery treatment program for a reason, to get the benefit of that program, that service, if we think it's valuable. That's the essential part of it. And so should it be directed that the court should be in a position to require that those service providers or that the language actually be provided in that same realm so they receive the service? Because that's the whole point of the program, not just of the program, but to get the service and the benefit from the program so that there'll be a change.
But I think that, and I hate to keep pushing things down the road, but I think it's an implementation issue to allow people the time to work with programs in their community to say, look, we're going to have to work together to find a way for you to provide these services to people. I think in some communities it'll be easier than others. We might want to look at rules involving the use of language line or other processes, or maybe some online work that would make. I think there are possibilities, but I think conceptually at the policy level, this is what we want to recommend, understanding that there are clear implementation issues.
I appreciate what the court is doing, but I also understand Judge Covarrubias' concern, because sometimes there's ancillary administrative agencies that are involved in some of these programs. For example, DMV doesn't care what the court does. If a person isn't in a certain program, their license is suspended. And so the coordination of all this is really very important. And I appreciate the comments that you made, Your Honor. And so to me, what I'd like to see is if the rule can give some guidance to the courts and to court executive officers, to be quite honest with you, because some of the ways that these issues are being dealt with is regionally. For example, in Marin County, what happens is that they sometimes will wait for a group of Spanish-speaking individuals to be ordered to a program. And when there's enough people ordered to the program, they then hold the classes. You know, whether it's theft awareness classes or other classes. And so I think that if we give guidance to the, you know, it says if a judge does not order the services, it could very well be that we give guidance to say that the court will work with the litigant to ensure the ability to gain access to programs that meet the requirements of the court and language access. And in that way, we can work together to ensure that there are no violations as a result of noncompliance. That's
okay.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Good idea. Yes.
I just wanted to add, you know, as we talked through this, the nomenclature was what got us caught up, because we use court-ordered/court-operated. And it was really helpful as we talked through it to talk about what we mean here in recommendation number 10 is something where language should say something like both court-ordered and court-operated, so that we're clear about what we mean. And that's how we in the group understood this recommendation. But then with the other language that Justice Zeilan was talking about, there you'd use language to talk about court-ordered but not court-operated. I just wanted to add that nomenclature to help everyone conceptualize what we're talking about in recommendation number 10.
Is that the nomenclature you're recommending?
I think that's what we talked about. So,
okay, that's good. Because that caused a lot of confusion. And we need to go through the whole plan and make sure we conform, other places would conform to that. Okay, moving on.
The next recommendation that we looked at was recommendation number 16, which is the conflict of interest recommendation. There were a couple of questions. This is one of the areas where the must versus shall language came up, and we're sensitive to the shall issue. And I guess our recommendation was that It read, when appointing a non-certified, non-registered interpreter, courts must not appoint persons with a conflict of interest, such as opposing parties or witnesses or family members of opposing parties or attorneys. So it would. It currently says courts must avoid, and it would then read courts must not appoint. And it would take out the existing clear or perceived conflict of interest language and replace it with conflict of interest. We also discussed with respect to this recommendation the issue of exigent circumstances where the interpreter is not available. There needs to be, for example, a continuance to the next week so that interpreter can be made available, or a witness is not available, but there's no interpreter available. Someone must be able to tell the litigant, come back next Tuesday. And we didn't think the rule should be read to preclude a family member or someone else in the courtroom who could explain a very simple concept. Saying that we
are you referring now to recommendation 17,
no.
Family members or friends?
No.
No, you're referring to 16 only.
In 16,
okay.
We think there should be an exigency exception, recognizing that it's easy to say and difficult to draft so that it remains narrow and focused. But we would recommend that there. 17, we view as a different problem. Again, there were a number of recommendations and comments in this area, one of which we completely agreed with, which is that in number 17, the court should inform the litigant before the use of a non-certified interpreter that a certified interpreter is available at no cost to the litigant. The litigant should have that information. The discussion on number 17 centered largely around the right of the litigant not to use a certified interpreter for reasons of their own. That is, they understood an interpreter was available and was free of charge, but they decided that they needed not to. The analogy we discussed was Feretta, where a person has the right, however ill-advised it may be in certain circumstances, to give up a free court-appointed counsel and represent themselves. And certain litigants may feel more comfortable with someone they know and trust than with some stranger in the process. And I think it was the view of our group after some fairly significant discussion that that right of the litigant should be respected, provided that, A, they have the information, and B, whoever they bring forward meet the provisional requirements that are set forth in this rule. This is a different issue than the waiver issue, which we didn't get to discuss but have on our plate, because the waiver is the waiver of any interpreter at all. This is the waiver of a court-certified interpreter in favor of someone of their own choosing.
And are you keeping C in, which is that there everybody has to consent to that person using a...
That was our contemplation.
And is there going to be, you don't need an exigent circumstances exception.
Correct.
Right.
The exigent would go in 16.
Okay. Any discussion on that? On those two, 16 and
17? Yeah. I have a question. I'm just trying to understand from the perspective of implementing the provisional qualification requirements start with the fact that you have to use a certified interpreter, and then if there's not one available, you have to go through the cross-assignment process and so on and so forth. So if they're waiving their right to have a certified interpreter, I don't see how we can say, A, if they meet the provisional qualification requirements, because that means we're going to do a good cause that we couldn't find a certified interpreter. I'm just kind of confused on what that would look like.
I think it would have to be rewritten so that that part of the provisional qualification requirement, that is the unavailability piece of it, would not apply here.
But it's a rule of court.
I don't know what a provisional requirement is then.
Well, they have to have certain abilities that's known to the court. I mean, if you look...
It's in the... I don't know. Is it in the rule? Is it in the
I'm
rule?
Just, I'm no sorry, I just was a little confused on.
I do. No, I don't.
I'd like to make a comment, please.
Okay. I,
I just think maybe we need to look at that. I'm not trying to be argumentative on it. I just didn't understand from an implementation perspective how I would roll this out. So maybe we just need to look at the language there and look at the provisional qualification, because
we have to look at Rule 2.893 and see how it could be written. And I just don't have that in front of me, and I apologize.
Okay, I'd like to make a comment. Lisa McNaughton, interpreter from Sonoma County. There is a reason why certified interpreters are certified. It's not an easy process to become certified, and the fact that a litigant may feel more comfortable with someone that he or she knows does not negate the fact that that person with whom the litigant feels comfortable may not be providing accurate interpretation. So not only is it part of the interpreter's MOU that we perform that service, not only is it the litigant's right to a certified interpreter, but it really makes no sense, in my opinion.
I would like to make a comment. Janet Hudick from Madera Superior Court, certified interpreter. I second Lisa. I think waiving an interpreter kind of defeats the purpose of meaningful language access.
But we're not talking about the waiver at this point. We're talking about selecting non-certified interpreter.
But they're basically just waiving the certified interpreter to choose family or friends to interpret. I mean, how are we really going to safeguard meaningful language access if that happens?
Could we look at this instead of looking at it from the point of view of someone having the right to not use their court-appointed attorney in order to self-represent, that a court interpreter is court staff, so it would be like someone saying, I don't like that judge, I want another judge. And sort of replacing court staff, so it's not an issue of replacing your representative because your interpreter is not your representative. It's a court staff person that's been qualified and certified to provide a service that the court provides, like a judge or a mediator, and that there's a process through which someone has to go through to disqualify a judge or disqualify a mediator. So if someone wants to disqualify their interpreter for some reason that we consider valid, then that's one. Their certified interpreter, court-provided certified interpreter, that's one thing. But choosing an interpreter is not the same thing as choosing an attorney.
And
it's just a reframe.
Well, I think perhaps the way you reframed it, this is Maria Rivera. In my head, what it means to me is the interpreter is not just for the person, the litigant. It's for the court,
exactly,
the other attorney, and everybody else involved. And so there needs to be an assurance that this person is interpreting correctly. And so, I don't know.
Just to add to that, interpreters are neutral parties. They have no interest in the case. So it just safeguards the justice system. Make sure that justice is being met in all angles.
I think that the requirement for a certified interpreter is actually in the statute, in the government code, as opposed to the rule.
Yes.
We're looking it up, but to see if we can find it. Any other comments on this issue?
Yeah.
This is Tracy Clark from Ventura Courts, Manager of Interpreting Services. Just a little point of clarification. There's two different forms, one to provisionally qualify somebody and then the certificate of unavailability. So what I hear being discussed is still going through with the provisional qualifications forms, but creating some kind of waiver where we don't have to certify that one was not available, but that everybody agreed to this provisionally qualified interpreter. To echo my other colleagues that are interpreters, I agree too. And, in fact, what Your Honor said, thinking of having everybody agree to the use of the provisionally qualified, because it's for the safeguarding of everybody who's depending on the interpreter, not just the one party that brought him in. But as to give another point of view of when this might come up, things do come up when they show up, and they didn't know they could get an interpreter, and they're told they can get an interpreter. Can you please come back even this afternoon? I don't have many OTS interpreters in my county. I have to hustle them in from L.A. and Orange County. And we've had people say, I can't come back in the afternoon. I'm going to lose another half a day of work. It's something very short. Can I just use this person? I think this is the thing we're talking about in those short things. Would the court have discretion to do that, to allow this person the same promptness in a matter where it might be possible to provisionally qualify them as someone who wasn't depending on an interpreter. And they're very often things like, yes, you're pleading not guilty, come back in a month, or there's no complaint filed against you yet, or your person hasn't been served for small claims, so we can't move forward today anyway, go to the small claims self-help center. One of those things, I can see where that might be a possibility. That said, the provisional qualifications form is not an easy, quick thing to fill out. You have to document a few things. You have to put it through. You have to get the judge or presiding judge to qualify them. So it's not something that I see being done on the spot without consideration and a real need to do it. So I guess I'm echoing a yes for the cautions we ought to take. I don't see anyone's friend coming in as being neutral or the attorney's assistant in small claims being neutral. On the same point, I think we're talking about two different things, availability versus provisional qualifications.
The statute says, except for good cause as provided in subdivision C, any person who interprets in a designated language shall be a certified court interpreter.
Okay, but then why do we need 17 at all?
I think 17 is intended to allow family and friends to interpret only if they meet provisional qualifications, which apparently doesn't happen a lot in court. Like small claims, you show up with your cousin, and your cousin interprets, and the judge never goes through the provisional qualification. And I think that was the intent of 17, is to make sure you don't let just any old person show up and interpret without going through at least the provisional qualification process.
Well, okay, I would say at this point that given this discussion, I'd like to take this back to Group 1 for further discussion.
And I think also it's kind of dealing with providing the immediate language act needs, because there are some courts that would not allow an individual to do that. And so the person would be precluded from having any type of access need at that point. And it's finding that medium or that place where you can be certified that someone, or satisfied that a person who is going to provide the language access service while we're going through this process and getting the number of interpreters available, getting the funding necessary, that there'd be some process in place and some procedures in places where a court officer then could possibly appoint someone if they're satisfied that the person at least meets his minimum qualifications while we fill the need. And so that if you have someone who has those abilities provided in a particular language, that they do it. Certainly not as a stopgap measure more than anything else.
So that would be a sunsetted provision?
I would think probably something like that. All this would sunset, I would think, once we have the full plan in place and this full implementation, what you're looking to. Because the full implementation is, the goal is to provide qualified interpreters, person who's been qualified, has been a certified interpreter, registered interpreter in all proceedings. And that would apply to small claims. It would apply to all civil actions without limitation. But certainly I would think that a person could decide not to use the court-offered interpreter, because they're going to have many interpreters out there who are still going to be independents. It can still be said, I don't want to use a court. I have my own certified interpreter, and bring that individual in. That would be something, okay, like someone has a right to counsel. Choose not to take court-appointed counsel, I'll bring my own counsel in, which certainly has the ability to do so. If in a Feretta situation, you're talking about someone going to go, in a sense, and represent themselves, but here they're not going to be allowed to have someone who's not a licensed attorney come in and provide that assistance. So
Can I just ask, though, I mean, maybe this is obvious and I'm missing, but it sounds as though, at this point, the way the discussion on 17 is going is, it sounds like we're setting up a process which is getting somewhat elaborate for a problem which is very small. And I'm wondering whether or not, maybe along the lines of Justice Zeland, perhaps, maybe 17 at this point is not really necessary, given the fact that the issue it intends to address is not very significant in terms of usage.
Well, if it's going to be expanded out to civil and family, where you're going to have some of these things being done, and one of the questions has been how much is being done now, what qualification analysis is being done by anyone who comes in to says, I come in and I don't have the money for an interpreter, not an interpreter in court, we're going to proceed today and they bring in this family friend or just someone from the community who may have some language access skills, and this is my interpreter because I can't afford an attorney, I can't afford the filing fees, and yet even though the court now can appoint them, if they have it, they don't have the resources. And so what do we do with those situations during the interim? And I thought that's what, in our plan, we were trying to devise some recommendations so the court would have to follow some process and not just appoint any person comes in, I'll be your interpreter, and says, do you speak English? Do you speak the target language? Say, yes, yes, okay.
This addresses the question of, is more always better? And more is not always better if the person doing the interpreting is not competent to do it. And that was, I think, the question we were addressing in number 17.
I would just note that FRERETA has a constitutional basis for it, as does the choice of attorney in California. Under case law, a person has the right to have the attorney of their choice. I don't know of any case law or any statute that says that you have a right to an interpreter of choice. And if there is, then I think it's important to note that, because we're basically creating potentially a constitutional right that doesn't exist. I do worry about this section. I worry about this section as a practicing attorney that supervises an office, and that is to say, you know, if worst case scenario is a situation where two lawyers are in cahoots, they come in, they decide to bring in an interpreter who is part of whatever thing that they want to perpetrate on the court. Nobody is sort of supervising the process of the litigation, and so basically you're almost inherently begging the worst case scenario, where you will have provisional requirements potentially that can come through. You have the admonition that's done, but then the potential for conflict by all parties in order to perpetrate potentially a fraud upon the court is really potentially existing in this whole line of recommendation, and I worry about it. I think that were this to happen, I mean, I don't see in 16, 17, or 18 that these are limited to exigent circumstances. That is to say, in circumstances where the court deems it necessary, and I think the court has to take a gatekeeper role in ensuring fair access to justice, and that means ensuring that interpretation is done in a neutral and professional and qualified manner. I think the court loses potentially the gatekeeper ability, especially if the court officer does not speak the target language and is at the mercy of the people appearing before them. And the only thing that assures the fair access to justice is a neutral. And I think that I commend Your Honor for wanting to take this back. I think the issues posed by these three things may seem like, you know, allowing the consumer choice, but potentially that choice could be used to undermine vulnerable people. And I think we have to be real careful of that.
Okay, so we'll table that one for now?
Yes.
Great.
And that's as far as we got.
And that's as far as you got. Okay. So the group two ideas, let me get my notes. Okay. So we looked at video remote interpreting and all of the many comments that came in on it. And so beginning with 11. The use of in-person certified registered interpreters is preferred. Yes, is preferred. And we debated whether either that preference should be made stronger, or the preference should be made weaker, or the preference should be removed, because we got all those views from commenters and concluded that we wanted to keep it in as it is, but that we wanted to add a standard to make it clear that what's important here is not what's important here is the ability to provide interpreting services that allow the court user to fully and completely and intelligently be engaged and understand all the court proceedings. So we don't have specific language crafted, but we wanted to put a descriptive standard that would say talk in terms of the quality of the interpretation is paramount. Remote interpreting is generally not a substitute. For an on-site interpreter, and the important factor is whether there is an effectiveness of communication that is not, the effectiveness of the communication is not compromised, controls are in place, and so on. I don't have the exact language, but it's a descriptive standard so that it's understood that, you know, we're not just saying, well, we prefer an on-site interpreter, but you can use VRI, but there's no clear definitive bottom line as to what are we trying to accomplish here. And so we're putting that standard in as a means to accomplish, to state what the goal is that we're trying to accomplish, which is to ensure accurate, complete, and total proper interpreting. So that's number 11. Discussion. Okay. Number 12.
Just one thing, I take it from the determining how it impacts, it'd be from the perspective of the court user.
Yes, right? Exactly. It's effectiveness of communication is no way compromised. What's the other language we're looking at? Courts should ensure that LEP court users are able to fully and meaningfully participate in the proceedings. It's a court user-oriented standard. Okay. The question posed in number 12, there was some comments that said that it did not appear to be strong enough because it referred people to Appendix B and said they should consider all these factors before they use remote interpreting, but it didn't appear they were required to. And so after some discussion, our group came to the conclusion that we wanted to turn that one should into a must and say that courts must consider at a minimum the specific factors set forth in Appendix B, blah, 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 before remote interpreting as used in the courtroom. And then with respect to Appendix B, what did we want to add in paragraph A? Oh, we realized it, or Ken realized, having an encyclopedic memory, that we didn't have any reference to Appendix D as in dog, as compared to B as in boy, which sets down the...
Actually, it was C as in cat.
Oh, C as in cat. Okay, I'm going to go to D first, though. We didn't have a reference to Appendix D, which is some minimum technology requirements, in Appendix B, where we said, you should be looking at minimum technology requirements without referring to Appendix D. So we're going to cross-reference those. And mention Appendix C, which is sample language for purposes of considering objections related to video remote interpreting, and make a reference to Appendix C in the body of the plan. We also want to move to the issue description, add to the issue description, which is not in there now, the preference for an in-person on-site interpreter, which was not discussed in the issue description, I was surprised to discover. So we definitely want to reinforce that by putting it in the right at the beginning. It's going to be like in the second paragraph of the issue description. That's all on 12. Does anyone have anything else? Yeah.
Just a quick question with regard to the requirement that the court consider the appendix. Would that be a finding that would have to be made on the record for each case, or can do we contemplate that the court as a system would make a finding and develop its own guidelines internally as to what cases they should use VRI?
That's a really good question. We didn't discuss that. It may be something we want to discuss now. We may want to say that that's really something the implementation committee should decide which is the best way to go about it. Ken?
Actually, we did discuss that in Appendix B, the first three requirements are really court-wide requirements that a court would look at and that the court as a whole would have to meet. Once you get down to D, that's in an individual proceeding, individual courtroom, where the bench officer will be making that determination.
Okay. Right, good point. What we didn't just talk about is when the bench officer does that, or is the bench, should the judge be making a finding on the record on each of these considerations? Should we have a form? Should we have a checklist? I think we'll probably leave that to implementation.
This is Ann Marks. I just want to point out that the way that it's currently written, the language is that the interpreter coordinator or the judicial officer or both should consider those. So it is something that might not happen by the judicial officer under the current writing.
Right. And there is encouragement to consult with the interpreter as well because they're experts as well to be consulted. Okay, anything else on 12? We proposed with respect to technology, we kind of left that open-ended and only had it in the appendix. So the group, in response to comments received, felt that somewhere, somehow, we should be directing somebody to set some minimum technology requirements. So what we're proposing is to add another recommendation that directs the implementation committee to prepare minimum technology requirements, that they be both for consecutive and for simultaneous, because there are going to be different kinds of requirements for each, and that they be reviewed and updated every 5 years. And we're proposing a set of requirements that allow for flexibility and using as an example a set of minimum requirements that came out from the CLAC report, the Council of Language Access Coordinators, and they got a nice list of minimum technology requirements that it does not appear to be too onerous, but does appear to set a good floor. Not that I really understand them, but the 1080p50, but it's a nice set that they can look at, and that in the meantime we're asking courts to use Appendix D to ensure that they have the kind of technology in place that will ensure that video remote interpreting is working. That's a new recommendation. Okay. Suggestions have been made that a pilot project should be used for video remote interpreting. And we kind of went around and around on that. And the reason we had not included a pilot initially is because courts were already doing video remote interpreting. And so we didn't think a pilot would be necessary and that courts would be essentially running their own pilots. And we would be gathering information about that. On the other hand, we have received these comments, and also a new technology plan has recently been prepared and presented to the Judicial Council, and in it they are proposing a pilot project for video remote interpreting for spoken language. And so we thought, well, what makes the most sense? And they have it in their plan that they're going to align their plan with our plan. So we thought it would make sense to go ahead and work with them on putting together some pilot projects. The pilot projects would not, putting in the pilots and setting them up and putting them together would not preclude courts from doing video remote interpreting, but it will provide an institutionalized way for us to gather information on the best way to do this, so that we can help deploy this throughout the courts. So we are proposing another recommendation that basically piggybacks on the tech plan's recommendation to prepare a pilot project for VRI. I believe in their plan, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's supposed to happen by the end of next year?
Yes.
Or second quarter? No.
Should be in a planning phase at this point.
At this point, right. Okay. Help me out, folks. I think that's all of our proposals.
Sorry, it's Q3 2014. So depending on what their year is, if it's a fiscal year, we might not be there yet.
Okay. I think my notes indicate that that's all the things we did in responses to comments. Anybody, did I miss anything? Members of my committee?
Okay.
Tom? I just wanted to address the issue that we talked pretty extensively about. We talked quite a bit about the successes of the ASL
yes.
Pilot, and we had a pretty lengthy discussion about the importance of distinguishing the criteria that will be necessary and all the differences between the technical requirements in for spoken language versus sign language interpreting. And so I think we came to the conclusion that we thought it was important to directly address somewhere in the plan, or at least reference those differences. And when we talk about the success of the pilot program, to state that those were successes with ASL interpretation, and so that once the pilot is designed and is implemented, that we'll be going into it focusing to at least some extent on those differences and trying to come up with guidelines and criteria that.
Thank you, Deborah, because I do have that in my notes and I forgot to read it. And the recommendation that we made, that we are proposing, is to set minimum tech requirements specific to visual and to spoken languages, and then specific to simultaneous and consecutive. And that's what I have in my notes, so that we're going to draft it up that way. We also talked about mentioning in the body on the issue description the success of the ASL VRI pilot, and also distinguishing the needs of interpreting needs for ASL versus for spoken language, and to make it clear that the success of the pilot project at ASL doesn't ipso facto prove that it works just as well for spoken language.
Tracy Clark, again, I just want to add one more thing to the strength of that discussion, which I thought was very good, and that was also that we recognize that ASL interpreters have had a different amount of experiential professional work with that technology, as well as training and in training and how to work interactively with other people depending on a remote interpreter. And we saw that as being part of what would become a very useful ingredient to the training and implementation of this moving into spoken language interpretation, along with different technological requirements. Did I capture that pretty much? Okay.
Sounds like a good summary. One more very small item on recommendation 14 about putting together a pilot project for short notice VRI that is being suggested there. We decided in response to some comments that limiting it to high-frequency languages as part of the recommendation is not necessary, so we're going to remove that from the recommendation. The pilot may use only high-frequency languages. It may not. We don't know. So we just decided we didn't want to hamstring ourselves that way. So that we're proposing to remove that. I think that's it. That's our group. So, group three.
Comment
over here.
Comment?
Comment.
Three.
Yes, this is Twi Nguyen. I think the notion of doing a pilot program makes a lot of sense. There's a lot of logic to it, especially what is already in play. In light of the fact that we also want other courts to, whatever they're doing, to encourage them to continue to do that, presumably that we still want that to happen. And if that's so, we may want to call that out even in our language, noting that, yes, we're doing a pilot project, but we still encourage other courts if they are doing any versions of their program. But we need to explicitly say that.
Are you talking about we want them to go ahead and do it, but they need to tell us what they're doing?
No. I think one of the comments made, you know, by the public member is around just some understanding. Well, for instance, one of the comments was one of the courts in the state is kind of holding off on interpreter availabilities, waiting for us. And I don't want the theme of courts not doing things on their own and just waiting for us. So one is not wait for us on the pilot project, only solely with one county. So if they're currently doing things statewide, that they should continue to do that, and we should very explicitly say that in here so people don't misunderstand, stop whatever you're doing, wait for our pilot. That's one. And then just overall theme, we may even make note of that in our phasing, our timeline. Don't wait for us necessarily on any of these phases. If you are ahead of the curve, keep going. And maybe even a communication before the adoption of our plan to address the current situation at hand.
Good points.
But on the pilot, the pilot project is for the centralized pool of interpreters, right?
There's two pilots. The pilot with the technology committee is on VRI, and the pilot that we're proposing for the Judicial Council is a statewide, what you have is a pool of interpreters that are available where you have a short notice problem. So Tracy calls up and says, it's 4:30, all my interpreters are tied up, all I need is 10 minutes of somebody's time to translate in French. You got somebody there. And it's a call-in thing that would be used for, you know, short matters and on short notice. That's a different pilot.
This is Ann Marks, if I can clarify. So the current recommendation that was in the draft was for the pilot that I think you just described out loud for using a centralized pool of interpreters. But the subcommittee was recommending a new recommendation for another pilot that would be piggybacking on or somehow in alignment with, not in addition to, the pilot proposed by the technology plans that were adopted in August.
That's the idea. The idea is that the implementation committee would work hand in glove with the technology committee to put those pilots together. Okay. Those were all the things that were on our plate. So we actually, they weren't all. We have a couple of other things that we didn't get to. But group three.
And I'll refer to Catherine Price, who will provide a summary of our group three.
Sure. And just before I do that, Judge Gomez-Rubias, if I may take a moment to just back up, and now that we're in public session and we have people on the phone and in the audience, to just do the little brief update about those two pieces of legislation that did pass.
Yes, please.
The first was AB 2370, which has become law and is effective January 1st, 2015, which builds upon current law to require a judge to verify on the record the certification or registration number of a certified or registered interpreter or the qualifications of a non-certified, non-registered interpreter who is appointed when neither a certified nor registered interpreter is available. So that's one piece of legislation that has become law and will be effective January 1st. The second bill is AB 1657, which has also been enacted, and also it will be effective January 1st. It declares the intent of the legislature to provide interpreters to all parties who need language services in all civil matters, authorizes a court to provide an interpreter to a party in civil matters
regardless of income, and creates a priority order for such services based on the availability of funding. The priority order is to be implemented by each court. So those are summaries of two important and timely new laws. In terms of the group that was with Judge Covarrubias, I will go through each decision that they suggested bringing forward to this full group. The first, and the group went slightly outside of what might naturally have been their bailiwick, but it's all related. So it has to do with recommendation number 19. Recommendation number 19 regarding the appointment of bilingual staff. The group suggests to the group as a whole that this be modified to contain the current information. Courts should avoid appointing bilingual court staff to interpret in courtroom proceedings, semicolon. If the court does appoint staff, he or she must meet all of the provisional qualification requirements. And the new change is to then add a cross-reference to what the provisional requirements are, including the current INT forms and related procedures. So that is the first suggestion to the full group. Do you want to take these one by one,
yes.
Justice Romero? Okay. Judge Covarrubias?
Any comments on 19? Any questions?
What's the change?
The change, again, is to have specific reference to what that qualification requirements are.
Oh.
And to make clear what is that process for having a provisionally qualified interpreter if you're going to appoint someone. If it's bilingual staff, that person would also need to meet those qualification standards.
Correct.
Noting again that it's a preference that they not be used and avoid them being used for a variety of reasons.
Right, which the provisional qualification process takes care of.
Right.
Right. Okay. Second one was the group considered and decided to suggest a change to 33 having to do with volunteers suggested.
I'm having trouble hearing.
Sure. The suggested new language for 33 is that courts should consider the use of bilingual volunteers to provide language access services where appropriate outside the courtroom, is the clarification. This is in response to consideration of various public comments received. So it's adding where appropriate outside the courtroom. And the next sentence is proposed to be revised to volunteers and interns should be extensively trained and properly supervised, are a reliable source for expanding language access, so long as their use does not conflict with any memoranda of understanding. That second clause is substantively the same, but we decided to take out some of the specific references to Justice Gore, as it was thought to be too specific, and that our real point was, like Justice Gore, to have fully trained and properly supervised. So that is the suggested replacement language for number 33.
Catherine, I wrote down one in this rewrite, must instead of should for volunteers. And I know that that's an issue that we want to be consistent on, so I don't know if that's something that we want to discuss openly.
Oh, I thought that it was still should.
We didn't have either should or must because it was a differently worded phrase.
Oh.
It said bilingual volunteers and interns are extensively trained and properly supervised. So and so we're adding a verb. I mean, we're adding a must or a should, and we haven't decided which one.
Sorry, I was looking at the should at the beginning sentence.
Yeah.
The second sentence, I'm not sure what the will of the group was. Judge Covarrubias, do you want to have must? Volunteers and interns must be properly.
If you're going to use them, they must be properly trained and supervised. That's the caption. That was the essence, I think, as a group that the work group is going on. And please chime in to those from the group that feel otherwise, that if we're going to use volunteers, we have to make sure that they are being trained and being properly supervised in all categories.
So noted.
That the court should use them, it's something that should remain as permissive. Surely not. There were some individuals that did make comments that we should not use any volunteers. Well, we just thought it was a resource that just is just too valuable not to recognize and use when appropriate.
Got it.
Any questions?
I was just wondering, in terms of the phrase outside the courtroom, is there any way that could be narrower so that it doesn't include a lot of the prep work that certified and registered interpreters do in preparation of, let's say, a jury trial or witness testimony, and, you know, to keep the meaningful continuity of the case flow going? That just sounds really general, well, a little general.
It was a specification based on public comment as to how it had been phrased before, so it is more narrow than it was in the prior iteration, but I think your suggestion is, should it be more narrow even further?
And this is voluntary providing language access services, that maybe someone who might be willing to sit at the counter to do these things, or someone who might be willing to provide some services in a self-help center or something like that to make sure they're being, they have the proper qualifications through the training that we describe within the plan itself, but not someone inside the courtroom itself, because it'd be outside the courtroom, not use them unless, again, they qualify under the provisional qualifications.
It does say in the suggested language, Deborah, it still has that qualification in the second sentence that says, so long as their use does not conflict with any memoranda of understanding.
Right.
So I think that's pretty covered.
Yeah. Thank you.
Does that satisfy your concern?
Could we say court proceedings, and then since we're going to be defining proceedings, then be clear on what that means?
But that's the problem. Are you including proceedings, all the outside work that Deborah's just talking about, prepping, you know.
Well, that's what I mean. So then we need to decide in court proceedings whether we're including all of that. That's what I'm wondering.
Okay. I think based on the way we were talking about defining court proceedings, it would be too broad for this.
Okay.
Ginger Lamar, and to tag on to what Kat said, we do have that it can't be in conflict with any memoranda of understanding. And we also discussed clarifying in the document, or it's already in the document, the difference between an interpreter and a bilingual employee, because a bilingual employee is not an interpreter. They're just having a conversation with someone. So I think this is clear that we're talking about just a bilingual volunteer who's talking to someone in an information sense versus interpreting the way interpreters are currently used.
That's a good point.
Is there a way we can narrow this down? I mean, basically, outside the courtroom can also mean certain mandated functions like mediation.
But those are already covered in another one, where we say you have to have a certified interpreter for that in mandated proceedings.
Right.
I'm just kind of seeing it more as an
outsider view. Somebody who reads it will understand just by looking at the word, this is exactly what they mean.
Well, maybe we can say something like, courts should consider the use of bilingual volunteers to provide information services to court users in their native language, or something to that effect. Does that address the issue?
If you defined it that way, on which side of the line would helping people filling out forms in the self-help center?
It sounds like information services to me, but I don't know.
Well, that's
others
what
might define it.
I'm thinking of what Justice Corps volunteers do.
Yeah, that's what they do. I think of that as being informational.
More than that.
I think it's a little more than that. That's why it's a little bit difficult to...
Okay, well, we certainly don't want to have them not helping fill out forms. That's for sure. Can we just ask staff to look at this issue and make it clear that what Ginger was just saying, this isn't interpreting, this is communicating in the language to assist in getting people where they're supposed to go and putting things down on the paper they need to put down on the paper. I mean, I'm thinking, for example, preparing orders after hearing. It's a crossover.
Right.
Interpreters do site translations of order after hearing, but somebody has to prepare the thing first. And I don't think an interpreter would be asked to actually prepare the order after hearing. That would be inappropriate.
it would be appropriate to ask for a site translation of it. So we're sort of in the middle.
I guess that's where the where appropriate is the qualifying language, because we have other language in the plan itself. We talk about when you were going to use bilingual staff and for what purposes, and making sure the services are appropriate based on the ability of that individual, because if they're on a counter, it's going to be one level of service. If they're going to be in a self-help center, it's going to be a higher level they're going to need to meet that level of service. If we talk about the volunteer, as Christina was saying, maybe you could do some pro bono work as volunteer interpreters. That would also fall within them being able to be in the courtroom. But again, it's bringing that policy statement to do we want to use volunteers at all? And because one of the recommendations, we should not use any volunteers. And we just thought it was too restrictive that we need to be able to use volunteers because they're a valuable community resource and it just provides that inroad to the community itself. So it kind of goes within the plan. But I think we can probably get some language here.
Staff can kind of probably come up. I mean, I think you hear what the issues are.
Justice Rivera, this is Scott Gardner, Judicial Council Human Resources. One thing I wanted to mention was it sounded as if, and rightfully so, this particular recommendation, we were putting in a tagline referencing being consistent with existing memorandum of understanding. I believe that would apply to all of our recommendations, wouldn't it? That we have to be consistent with existing memorandum of understanding. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but I was concerned that only this one was referring to existing memorandum of understanding, and maybe we should be having some kind of an overarching statement that would be a recommendation. I don't know.
Any comments? I mean, I think that's true. I think the reason it's only in a handful of these is because it only appears to implicate the memorandum of understanding in certain ones. Other ones don't implicate, like training judges doesn't implicate the memorandum of understanding and other things. So there are many in here that wouldn't even come close to.
Yeah, because there's been some other things we've discussed today which don't have that, which would potentially, as the VRI issues, where we've got existing memorandum of understanding and agreements on those points. So,
well, I think that might be a good idea, is just to put a global caution in there that says all of these recommendations have to be consistent. I don't know, consistent with a memorandum of understanding, but consistent with, you know, rules, statutes. I don't know.
I thought it was in the plan already.
It's in the plan.
I just was, you know, thinking, oh, if it's referenced specially here, why is it referenced specially here when it applies everywhere?
That's a good point. Is this a good time to take a break? Okay, let's give everyone a 10-minute break. Please be back here at 3.
Two more things that came out of the group three to bring to the full group. The topic regarding numbers and percentages, there's a need to be more consistent and thoughtful throughout the plan as to how we're referring to percentages regarding top five languages, 5% of population, countywide, communitywide, et cetera. So the thought was to have a single consistent statement every time that is referenced, but the single consistent statement will be correct me if I'm wrong from the group, countywide, top five languages, or 5%, whichever is more, and that footnote, additional data gathering to be done with regard to additional pieces of information that should be looked at. But that was going to be the baseline statement every time that is referenced. Judge Covarrubias, is that correct?
Does that make sense?
Questions?
This is through the whole plan.
Right. When you say additional data collection to be done, you're referring to the other forms of data that have been referred to by some of the commentators, education department data, welfare department data, things of that nature?
And also to be looking at, for example, one of the thoughts was when we have disparate communities that are within one county that is served by one superior court county of, that comparisons be done between, say you have two large cities but that are very different from one another in their top five languages, that your baseline starting point is county-wide, top five, or 5%, but then more information to be done to compare and contrast the varying natures of that, and so that you can go 5+, but there was wanting to set a baseline.
Christy Kessman. Small and mid-sized courts are going to have a hard time with the top five. In our instance, we have two. We have Spanish and we have American Sign Language. And then we have one, probably five other needs, one each language, one each case, and that's it. So for a smaller mid-sized court, I think that's might pose a problem. I mean, right now we gather the data and everything, but when you're talking about the top five, you're really not going to get anything from a smaller mid-sized court in that area.
So more from the group that was discussing this, I think the context that we were looking at was the contrasting example wherein a third alternative being for any group of 500 or more, that was too much for large volume counties. But thoughts from the group, Christina, not sure if you had a thought with respect to the smaller county population issue.
No, we should just break the state into six parts. That's my suggestion. That's what we're dealing with, is trying to figure out how we make sure that we capture communities, all the communities in a local area, and but also not make it over burdensome when you don't have that situation that you're explaining. So it sounds like we probably need to have more discussion about what kind of language we want to put on the plan to give people flexibility within their community's needs, but at the same time not let them not provide that access to the community. So we have to have some sort of minimum threshold, but at the same time you sort of account for these issues. So I don't know.
Judge? Wouldn't it be if we said top five or, 5+, right, exactly. Okay, so you don't have five, right, in your example. So that's fine. You have the top five is only two. That's all you have. The minimums.
Is it or 5% or is it and 5%? And anybody who you have above 5%.
I thought it was supposed to be read as the more inclusive, whichever approach is more inclusive.
Thank you.
Is that correct?
Yeah, but in your case, it would be top five would be more inclusive than 5%, which means you're still stuck with the top five. So the new language that we were proposing or the consistency wouldn't actually address the situation you raised.
Would there be a way to set a minimum, like the top 5% or the top five languages or 5%, or in small counties, instances of over so many translations per year, and come up with a number that seems reasonable for the small courts if you did over 20 translations in that language during the year. I don't know what reasonable looks like right now, but maybe there's a way to add something else.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense to have the top two languages, the top five languages, if the third, fourth, and fifth language have five people. So can we have a threshold number? The problem with using number of translations or interpretations is you're only looking backwards and you're not looking forwards, and the whole point of the data gathering process is to assess language needs in the community so you can get out ahead of them. And so
and that you can make them feel welcome in the court by putting stuff out in the language, and it may be a new community that's come in, you know, Senegalese or something like that. So, but I think a critical mass of population would work. I don't know, 500, I don't know.
I think we have to be careful about quantifying by number. And the reason I say that is that in some of the public hearings that we had earlier when this committee first began, we had, you know, people coming in from the Central Valley who were part of new indigenous people coming into the valley. They're a small number, yet were asking us to ensure that they were included in this process. This recommendation, I think, is not going to be something that's going to be done by one court alone. I think the whole language access plan is a collaborative plan. And I think it's going to call for assistance at a statewide level. When we talk about what the implementation committee can do for local courts, what it can do is give demographic information, potentially hire demographic groups that will tell counties, by the way, here are the five languages spoken in the communities you serve. And then the court can potentially create translations of the 25, 30 most commonly used languages around the state, and be able to produce, you know, documents such as this, signage such as what was provided to us to make a different point. And so I think that it's also, you know, very important to kind of know that that's just going to be part of the implementation process. If we set these goals, then, you know, the goal is not to let small counties sort of feel that they are going to have to work to get the information. But there are these small pocket communities that need to be served in the judicial system. So I just wanted to ensure that we talk about that. I'd also like to, if I could, go back a little bit to when we talked about bilingual volunteers.
And I will let you. But do you have suggested language if we're not going to use numbers beyond the obvious ones? Do you have something that you would propose that you would like to have staff work on that is conceptual?
You know, I'd have to think about that because it is a big concept. I mean, to try to narrow it down to one sentence. So if I could be given time to propose something to them, that'd be great.
Okay, thanks.
Right off the cuff, I could.
And the other one?
The other one with regard to bilingual volunteers and interns is something that I think is an issue of a scale, and that is, this plan calls for a tremendous amount of interpreters to come on board if we're really going to be able to assist the statewide components. I know one of our colleagues mentioned the notion of why in this particular section was there a reference to the memorandum of understanding when that should be a global issue. One of the things that I also appreciated earlier in the year was that the CFI representative indicated that the court interpreters were going to be collaboratively working with this committee, and I heard the comments today that once again echoed that spirit of collaboration with regard to this. And my hope is, as we talk about things in terms of interns and volunteers, that CFI and the other unions that represent interpreters throughout the state can look at some opportunities to be able to assist in some of the goals that are there. I think specifically when we talk about volunteers and interns being adequately trained and adequately supervised, that they could be an integral part of assisting in creating programs within their contracts that would allow for that kind of enhanced training and supervision that might be very, very helpful. Because I think that if this language access plan is going to take root into the state, it's going to take everybody working collaboratively, and these kind of issues, I think, point out those things.
Thank you.
What does the data show if we decide not to do the top five and just do 5%? What does the data show in terms of counties that may result in 20 languages or 10 languages that are just too overwhelming for them? Do we know that is a problem? Because I'm wondering why the need now, in light of the comment of the top five. If it's simply, you know, just 5% critical mass, let's say I'm in LA County and I have 10 languages that are above 5%, oh, by golly, surely, you know, provide services for all 10, actually. So it may be worth it as a proposed language to just get rid of the top five and do 5%.
then it addresses both the small and the big.
Well, I think what Jose is saying, though, is if you say 5%, you could have, you know, Mixteco, Zapoteco, you know, five different Trini, all those different indigenous languages, very small numbers of those people. And yet we need to figure out a way to serve them as well. But that's not what we're talking about. We want to serve everybody.
Yeah.
What we're talking about is thresholds for certain kinds of outreach. So we need a... It doesn't make a lot of sense to prepare outreach material for 20 people. It does if you're 5% of the population. It's more than justified.
Right.
So...
And 1% of the population of LA County is much more than 1% of the population of Alpine. And so so you're reaching, you know, so 5% cuts off. I mean, there might be counties, I believe that there are, I just don't know that the numbers, that may have 98% of their LEP population, maybe 98% Spanish speakers and 2% something else. But they may still represent significant numbers. And so if we just say 5%, then stuff only gets translated to Spanish.
But the top five will not then capture
right.
that group anyway.
No, the top five would capture that group because Spanish would be the first one, and then there's room for four more. And that was part of the alternative. I mean, some language and statutes in the government code talk about a substantial number. I forgot the exact language of the... of the Diamond-Galatory Act, but it's a substantial number of residents or a substantial number of users or mm-hmm. consumers.
It's not a numerical.
No, but then it's been interpreted to be 5%. So it could
right.
be that we want to suggest top 5%, or where a court, given its own individual demographics, after consulting data, you know. And we use substantial number of residents, and then that court needs to determine what that is, and we provide some guidance on how to determine those numbers.
If we said the top five with a minimum of 5% for each, would that help? I mean, we're really talking about the smaller courts and mid-courts, and one of the ideas, at least in implementation that I spoke with others, is about having a toolkit that would allow them, again, to use those in the implementation. I designed a toolkit where they would have certain formulas, certain ways to go out and use these to determine what is and how do you determine your top five languages and to provide some guidance for them. But it seems that we're talking about five languages. If they meet a minimum of 5%, that would, at a minimum standard, not that it could be more than that. It wouldn't preclude them from having more than that, but if it was a... If you have five top languages, at least have a minimum of 5% in there. That might, if you don't have 5%, you only have 1%, then because you don't have your five languages, you only have the two. That would be a significant amount to, again, we're not talking, the language services are going to be provided whatever the percentage is, whatever it's going to be. It may be that one individual in your county, but they're going to be entitled to have the language access services. The issue becomes, do they have the publication, all your formative notices that we're going to do? Are they have to be in those top five languages?
Yes, it's the brochures.
All everything else that goes on there. But the services are going to have to be provided, and you have to be ready to provide services whatever language it would be in.
It just occurred to me that these materials, we're talking about the kiosks or electronic media, they can be prepared on a statewide basis, and then the individual courts can choose which ones they implement. So to the extent that we're trying to determine, you know, should the court go and hire and do this on their own, we can decide maybe once it's implemented what languages are going to be participating on a state basis, and then each individual court could then easily download and get that material and display it on the screen or tablet or however it says electronically.
Yeah, the I think that's a really good point, in that, you know, using statewide resources is a lot better than trying to use local resources. But some of these brochures are going to be local. They're going to have the court address and directions to the court and all of that stuff. And so we still need to give guidance to the courts as to how many languages you need to prepare these brochures in that you're going to hand out to the community organizations. That's the problem. But Jose is going to work on language.
Yes, I am.
Okay. So are we tabling this one?
Yes, I think we need to.
Yeah, Jose needs time to work on it, so we'll bring this back. And the last thing to pull out to the big group from the small group was the decision to reorder between recommendations 66 and 62 for a more logical connection having to do with the complaint process. That's the level of agreement, I think, that we got was reordering. There was quite a bit of other discussion, but no other agreement.
Yeah, we're still working on the actual complaint process for denials of language access or challenges or complaints about the level of service that was provided by an interpreter, whether or not it was accurate or not, but after even denial of services, and that is something that we're still working on. We haven't completed.
Regroup, you mean? Mm-hmm. Okay. And those are recommendations 62 to 66?
Yes. Other than reorganizing it, because I think there was a consensus that the complaint process, whatever it be, that there should be a complaint process in place without a doubt. But the first step should be at the local level to be seen with the community address at local level. The difficulty comes in is challenging, do we get everything and any complaint into a statewide form? We won't have a uniform form. Does it all go to the judicial council someplace to have the registry of complaints, or just those that are not resolved in a satisfactory manner to the court user? And that's something we should discuss.
Right. I had a question. Did you address number 47 and 48, which is the issue of the minimum oral proficiency for bilingual staff?
Yes.
We did address those two, and just pulling back up my notes here, the decision, the suggestion from the group was no change to 47 and no change to 48.
Okay.
Although they considered the public comments. With regard to that, there were serious trade-offs to raising the suggested minimum up even higher. Taken in totality, those recommendations allow for raising it, depending on the point of contact, at details to be determined. But there's not a suggestion to change 47 or 48 at this point.
Okay, so the 47 and 48 now basically provide that any bilingual staff has to be proficient at intermediate, mid, and that it is up to the court or the judicial council staff working with the courts to identify higher standards for for different points of contact in the court, such as self-help centers, clerk's windows, traffic windows, etc.
Correct.
One of the biggest concerns is that if we raise it higher, that we would actually be reducing our language access by excluding a lot of individuals who can provide that informational process there at the beginning, at the counter and things of that nature, that you might lose at those individuals at that point in time that you already have, who may not meet that higher level.
Okay. Any discussion on 47 and 48? Okay. Okay, I think is that all the recommendations that you got to? Okay.
Yes.
So we, in going through the comments, we identified two that we felt were fairly prominent in all of the comments that were raised with frequency. And one was the use of should versus must or should versus shall, or but you know, the precatory versus the requirement. And I'd like to see us have a discussion about that. And the discussion, without going through each of the 90 recommendations we have, which would be kind of burdensome, I'd like to have a discussion about how we want to articulate when it should be a should and when it should be a must. And if there's a way
that we can articulate that and then have staff go back all the way through the plan and say, oh, this falls on this line, this falls on that side of the line, and then in the close questions, you know, we'll have to break the tie. My thought is that provision of actual language services is always going to be, almost always going to be must. It's going to be a requirement. We should be actually providing language services to court users who show up at court, and that more leeway needs to be given when we talk about, okay, how is this county going to gather data, and how is that county going to gather data, and how is this county going to do public outreach, and how is someone else going to do public? Those should be, perhaps we should think about saying you must do public outreach. How you do it is up to you. We think about that. But I'm trying to imagine categories, broader categories, of when we really want to suggest to the Judicial Council that these be required actions versus actions that everybody should be striving to achieve. And whether anyone has thoughts about that or has thought about it or even has narrow, very specific ideas about where things should fall on the line.
I think one of the most important things is to give guidance to the trial courts. I think that when we talk about buy-in and the implementation of this program, I think as a policy matter, the more that any of the recommendations can be voiced, placed in a sort of language that gives clear guidance to the trial court, I think will make it much easier. I mean, because then we basically are giving them the roadmap to ensuring the most important priorities, and so to me, that would be the ideal place to start. Is does this give guidance, or is this simply sort of commentary recommendation that could be placed? I know that may simply be begging the question, but I don't know any other way to sort of place it in these recommendations.
That's a very good factor. Are there any other factors that we want to think about?
When I think about it, I think, you know, part of this plan is statewide consistency and creating some minimum standards for what each court does. So when we're talking about what minimum standards are required, I think that's the appropriate use of must or shall. I think there might even be some disagreement on which of those two words to use. But if it's how you do it, and you know, that recognizes that each court is so different, so when you get to the how question and we're providing guidance on how you might do it, I think that's where you get to the should, because they were trying to provide guidance where there's discretion. I also think even if it's a minimum, but you know, I can't think of an example. The plan is big, but if there's three different things, you know, among the minimum criteria is one of these three, of course it should be appropriate language to make clear that trial courts have discretion from among those three minimums. But I think my biggest point is to say we have to be extraordinarily careful, because this plan's only going to work if trial courts have the true discretion to implement it properly. And there's so many complexities out there that as much as we want a uniform system and kind of feel that we have consistency and mandates and everything else, I think if we go too far in that direction, the plan's going to fail. Because, as somebody said earlier, MODOC is so different from L.A. County.
Yes?
This is kind of going in a different direction, but one of the areas where I think we might want to be more mandatory is in record-keeping and reporting, because by requiring, by obtaining that information, the council will be able over time
to fine-tune this and to see what resources are needed that aren't being provided. And, you know, any record keeping, any additional record keeping is a burden for the trial courts. And if we are going to be assured of getting it, I think it maybe should fall into that mandatory category. But I think it's very important for evaluation of whether we're being the most efficient at providing the services we're trying to provide.
Yeah.
Dennis?
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think the general tenor of this conversation being that, as I think you stated earlier, that the provision of the fundamental language service itself is always a must. And I think any of the support services of the court, which is fundamental to the delivery of the language service, is also a must. And included in that category, sort of piggybacking what Justice Elon said, the initial intake of identifying language needs is fundamental. And I think in our discussion,
you mean the tracking of it.
Yeah, the tracking. Yeah, is fundamental. And the whole gap, I think, beyond the record keeping that we've talked about, is that this initial identification issue is one that courts are going to have to build into their intake system. I mean, there's just no way, and I can see courts being somewhat resistant because A, that's it could be complex, and B, it could be expensive. But I don't think we can emphasize enough that that is a must in terms of what courts are going to be obligated to do in order to provide the languages that are necessary.
Right. Well, I mean, if we're going to get funded,
yeah, we
need to have the data. So you're right. Okay. What about the more ancillary things like public outreach and information and things like that?
Yeah. I'd like to add one more thought to the mandatory, must, shall, whichever language we choose. And that is two things, the verification on the record that the interpreter being used is properly credentialed, certified, registered, or if not, then the provisional qualification is done as required by the current form. And the second thing is the training for the judicial officers, for staff, for everyone on the language access plan, which in the recommendation 50, it actually says that the staff will receive systematic training, and I don't know if this means must or should. So I think that without the training, none of this would work because no one would be aware what they have to do.
Right. Well, and one of the things that came up over and over again in the hearing process was how poorly trained judges are in managing courtrooms with interpreters and dealing with interruptions and noise and background and speed and all of that problem. So that training. But I see what you're saying. You're talking about training specifically about this plan and what the courts are expected to do.
And what's required,
right.
Yes.
And that's where Manuel's toolkit idea comes in. Okay.
One additional, we have it right now as a will as opposed to a should, and I think it should stay as a will, and that is a complaint process to ensure that litigants who are denied language access services are able to make complaints about those services, or if they're receiving inadequate services, they're able to make those complaints. And we should also be requiring a statewide compilation of those complaints. We talk about, there was talk about the reordering of between 62 and 65 or 66, whichever it was. But I think it's important that we not only try and address complaints locally, but we also try to solve problems systematically. And if we realize that there's a systematic problem because we're seeing the same complaint come up over and over and over again in different counties, we want to, as a system, be able to address that complaint and not wait for people years later to say, oh, yeah, we're having that complaint in our county as well.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry. Taking notes.
This is very interesting to hear the conversation because words like will, must, shall, there's sort of semantics, and I have a feeling we may be thinking differently about some of these terms too. So I don't know if there's real clarity even on the word and what they really mean. But with that said, using your dichotomy of
must and should. I think it's very hard for us as a public policy advisory group to put in place public policy statements and not use the word must. Because if we're saying it's important enough as a public policy, then it seems to suggest that it's a must. And if it somehow borders the should arena, then maybe it should call into question whether that should be more toward the implementation committee or less of, you know, a public policy statement, a role that we could play. Because otherwise, if we're doing this as a public policy, and I'm just thinking even within my own client entities, when you're bored, you're making public policy statements, it is definitely a must.
So, for example, if we say in Recommendation 53, courts should establish partnerships with local community-based organizations, including all the following, to gather feedback to improve court services and disseminate court information and education, that should be a must, not a should.
If we believe that this is a critical public policy statement, otherwise it starts to sound like an implementation mechanism, right, to get partnerships and to do certain things.
Okay. So maybe what we're saying is we need to go back through the recommendations and figure out which ones are the must, and then the ones that are shoulds, which tend to sound more like the hows, the how-tos, we can put in, maybe take out the recommendations and just say the implementation committee should make suggestions and provide information about how to do this.
I think, you know, let's do that list because based on that we may have, it depends, you know, if it's a lot or a little, but I think that may be a worthwhile exercise.
Okay, that's a good point.
Just as fair. It would, rather than lose any of that work, too, it would be possible to create an additional appendix of additional ideas for implementation considerations or something like that so that it doesn't get lost altogether.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm thinking, I don't know if this works. Just off the top of my head, I was reading. The recommendations, there's four of them in a row, and they are all shoulds, and they all relate to public outreach, public information process, creating videos and multilingual audio recordings, and disseminating information. And maybe your idea, I mean, I love the idea of having fewer recommendations because we have so many. Maybe we should go through the exercise of taking that down to one must recommendation that includes the components and then putting somewhere so we don't lose it. These are all the things that you can do to accomplish that. Mm-hmm. But that's a very interesting approach. Thank you. Okay, anything else on this subject?
Maria, just this is Miguel.
Yes.
Just real quick, so I'll confess I don't know where MODOC is, but I just looked up and they have 10,000 people or 9,986 people or something like that. MODOC.
Yeah.
And so what you just said about, you know, public relations or points of contact and all that, I wonder if that's even feasible to be done in MODOC. So I think anytime we use must, we really have to think about all 58 counties and whether it's feasible within those counties, because that must to me is so important. I agree with everybody that we have to use it to make this document effective. But we have to be also think carefully about, you know, MODOC and others.
Right, and Alpine has 700 people or something like
Your
that.
Your Honor, I was just thinking about exactly the same thing as I was drafting language in response to what you asked me to.
What percentage?
And I thought, I didn't reach a percentage. I actually thought that one of the points that was just made by Justice Marcus is really on point. And the language that I came up with was, courts must provide notice of the availability of language access service and related language access policies at point of contact with the courts in English and up to five languages based on local community needs assessed through due diligent communication with the public, community-based organization, justice partners, legal services offices, and other entities working with ELP populations. That standard basically allows the local courts to actually interactively get involved with their communities. And if, in fact, they only have two major language groups, that may be the amount that they would have to do based on their local community needs. But the notion of due diligent communication gives a standard on what they have to do. It means that they have to, you know, whether it's notice communication, whether it's doing some of the things that are later spoken about in that particular recommendation, it does give you a guidance, again, to understand that, yes, you can don't have to do up to five, but you do have to do this. You know, if you don't get to five, you have to show that you at least did some due diligent efforts to find out what communities needed to be served. And it could very well be that the serving of those communities may not involve the printing of massive articles after they converse with the community members.
Right. Another suggestion would be maybe to consider it, and maybe there's different standards that we should set for the different types of areas where we've been talking about the numbers. Maybe we need to revisit that and slice it further.
That's a good point. I don't remember how many we have thresholds in. Just four? Four of the recommendations? We have thresholds? Okay, any other discussion on the must-should dichotomy? Lisa?
I'd just like to express the fact that I've noticed that there's a great deal of collaborative language coming out of everybody here, and it sounds very good.
Thank you.
Everyone seems to be agreeing that if we're going to have a plan, it must work.
And I would not indicate that that's the report we've seen back, even when we put out the plan in different forums. We did one to the state bar. We've also met with other organizations to get these out, and we've actually been very positive in their responses. They're just saying, okay, we want to make sure we need the resources to be able to implement that, and they all seem to indicate that it's a long time that it's been needed, that this need has not been met, and it's time to meet the need. And they just are looking to see where the resource is going to come to meet that need. But from administrators to judges to line staff, they're all so very supportive and said this is a long time coming, because they recognize that it is a need that we need to fill and meet. And just hopefully the resources will come.
Okay, I want to move on to one other what we're calling a meta issue, which is an issue that we saw repeated in many, many comments, and that is the timeline and the phasing in all of these various recommendations. Some people actually think the timeline's too short, that it's not going to be possible to get all of this done by 2020. Most people commented that the timeline was too long and that we needed to work with greater urgency. And of course, we all know that if we had a very large pile of money, that even wouldn't solve the problem, because we also need to add interpreters who are as good as our existing interpreters. And as we all know, that is very hard to accomplish. It's to recruit and train and support in passing the test of more interpreters so that we can deploy them to all these various places where they're needed. So resources is just, I don't think that there's a lack of desire. I think if everybody in this room would agree, if we could do all this tomorrow, we would all agree we should do it tomorrow. So the issue is, what is logical in terms of phasing in pieces of the plan, both because of resource issues, but also because of infrastructure issues and things like pilots and other things that need to happen, and just getting ourselves organized. I mean, one of the things is, let's make more videos. Okay, well, we got to get some curriculum people involved, and we got to get, you know, all the experts in, and we got to decide what the most important videos are, and then we have to figure out how we're going to pay for them, and then we have to actually write the script, and so on and so forth. So all of these things take time, and some things take more time than others. Putting together a comprehensive training component on interpreting and the plan and everything is going to take time. Having said all of that, my question to the group, to the committee, is, are there either general or specific changes you think we should make to the phasing plan that we have now? Now, we've already moved family court services into phase one, and we've already moved creating the rule on provisional qualification for civil to phase two. Other than that, I don't think we've changed anything. Oh, and moved the interim process for provisional qualification for civil to phase one. Other than that, everything remains as it was, except phase three. We moved recommendation eight into two rather than three phases.
Right.
The goal is to achieve that in two phases. So, apart from that, I don't know. I think maybe what I want to do is alert you to that and give you homework. And the homework would be, in the back of the plan is the handy-dandy phasing list. And if all of you could take a look at the comments about the timeline and then look at this phasing list and see if you have any suggestions about how we might improve, change, alter. I don't think there's an... I mean, we'd love to have it all done tomorrow, but trying to get it done faster is not necessarily better. And so I don't think there's any default setting of we should move faster on everything or slower on everything. I think we need to look at these things on a subject-by-subject basis. So unless somebody has some comment they want to talk about now on phasing, we can do it tomorrow. Yeah.
I just have a general question, and maybe everybody else is clear, and I'm the only one confused at this point, but... as I was reading through the comments on the phasing and where things belonged, I started getting confused because in the language of how we define phases, we talk about, for example, phase one, actions to begin implementing of these recommendations should begin by year one. Phase two may begin immediately and should begin by years two and three. Some of the things we put in phase two, we put in phase two because we didn't think we could get it done by phase one. However, it should get started right away. And, for example, like a rule of court or statutory changes. So, but by saying that they may begin immediately but don't have to until years two and three, we're sort of pushing out the need to start right away with something that may be qualified as a phase two. You know what I mean?
Okay, I think I see what you're saying. So here's my thought. My thought is that everything should get started unless it can't. In other words, one of the things we say in defining phase three is, well, we put things in phase three that we can't even start until some other things have been done and completed in phase one or phase two. But it seems to me that the easy way to resolve that is to say everything starts now. And if you can't start now, it starts when the predicate thing happens, and then it starts. But it has to be done. And that's where the phasing comes in. It has to be done by the end of that phase, accomplished. So when we talk about training, for example, training is ongoing. It has to be done all the time. You have to do it over and over and over again. So putting together the curriculum would be something we would want completed within one of these phases.
How much discretion do we want or need to leave to the implementation body to rethink some of that phasing based on practical considerations as they go through and try and put together the on-the-ground pieces for this? And how does that affect what you're talking about?
What's the answer? From your experience?
From my experience, I think we have to recognize that some things are going to play out differently than the way that we think they are on paper, and that we have to leave the implementation group some discretion to do things in a way that makes sense and recognizes the resources they have available. For example, if we sunset in December and the implementation group starts in January, they may find that they have no resources in terms of actual dollars to do certain things. And they may be phase one things, and they may have to decide, well, we can do all the prep work for this without those resources, but we can't actually roll it out. I mean, and it's very hard to predict that, but things like that do happen. And I'd hate to see us, on the one hand, leave it so loose that we really are making an empty promise, but on the other hand, straitjacket the group that's actually going to have to get on the ground and do it.
Yeah. I think the language in the plan, it reads as follows. To assist courts and all interested persons in understanding how the various recommendations can be gradually phased in, the plan groups these recommendations into one of three categories. So I don't read this as saying this is mandated for this phase. I read this as us making our best guess at how this is going to roll out most logically. And maybe what we can do on page 14 is say that. And say, but of course, in the actual implementation of the plan, things may look different. Okay. We can do that at page 14.
Justice, I have a concern about the transition. And the whole notion of sunsetting, the whole notion of an implementation committee coming down. I mean, you could be adding 6 months to a year to this program. And I can tell you that what most implementation committees do is they rethink the policy things that were done. Oh, these people didn't see this, or we're going to change. And sometimes there's a delayed component. And I think that time is the essence. If we're talking about 2020 and some of these things that are going on, and I worry that if there isn't a continuity built into one of the policy recommendations that can continue to follow through, we may lose some really valuable committee institutional history that would be valuable to the both the implementation and to policymakers making decisions on budget. And so, to me, that concerns me. That concerns me that you know, we say, oh, we're done. We did it to the Judicial Council, and yet we are potentially experts that may not have their expertise sort of utilized as subsequent committees go on and add years to this process.
I want to ask Bonnie to respond to that, and also Lori.
Hi, I'm Bonnie Heff with the Judicial Council staff. My experience with implementation committees with the Judicial Council is they're usually created within a week or two of the report being adopted. I don't know if that's going to be possible, but they're usually appointed quite quickly, and they usually consist, often they're smaller than the original policy send group, but they usually have huge overlap, if not, you know, full membership. So I can't speak to how this will happen, but that's been my experience with all the implementation committees that I've worked on.
Thank you.
For all those reasons.
And because Bonnie was one of the key staff people on the Elkins implementation, all I can do is say, yeah, that's right. I mean, I think the issue for us is going to be adding some people on the IT side and on some of the more technical pieces that we don't have now. And I don't know that we've actually made a recommendation or started thinking about what our recommendation to the council will be as to the membership of the implementation committee.
Yeah, we haven't even looked at that. I'm not sure that's going to be part of the plan at all.
But, you know, that's when the council tells you to move, you move. In my experience.
I just wanted to make an observation with respect to the phasing aspect, which is if you're going to flip to do a finish by instead of initiate by model of the phasing, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, there probably will need to be a pushing out of some of those phasing dates. For example, just the amount of time it gets to get a BCP in and processed
a BC budget change proposal, for example, to fund the full expansion. So a lot of those things could be accurately described as begin within this phase. But if it's going to be switched to complete by this time, realistically, some of those deadlines would need to be pushed out further.
Okay. Okay, we'll have to look at that. So that's the homework assignment, everybody. Look at the phasing and see what you see. Those are the issues, the meta issues that I really wanted to get out and talk about, and particularly do this in open session. There are some closed session issues that we were not able to complete, but because we didn't want to delay the beginning of the open session. And what I'd like to do now is to go back to closed session, complete those items, and then we'll return tomorrow to open session at 9 o'clock as scheduled to complete the work that we have to do. Is that okay with the committee? Okay. Great. We are adjourned to closed session, and let's go back to our rooms, and we welcome you back tomorrow. Thank you for being here.
Now, we will not meet as a group again. Mm-hmm. We won't meet as a group again, right? We're going to keep our same schedule.
Yeah.
We have to change our schedule for the morning.
Well, we'll decide that.
I think that's not what I told
them.
Yeah.
I don't know. The ladder sounds better. Although we have an hour left to work, so.
That feels poppy, yeah.
Before we come back.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you see this? People might leave early, but we're going to come back.
So we're going to game four? Is that it? I heard you said that you were inviting me to game four.
I've got a 10-year-old son. 2 years ago, my wife and two sons are going with me to all playoff games. Okay, I had an 8-year-old son at that time, and now I've got a 10-year-old son. After game three of the World Series against Detroit that was played in Detroit, I get a call from my wife, and that's the road. I call from my wife, and that's the road. So my son really wants to go to the next home game, and he says, Mom, do you realize there may not be a next home game, but, we can win one of the next two and eliminate Detroit, and people, Brian's going to cry.
Oh, my God.
He is.